This episode was made possible by a grant from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Commonwealth History Fund presented by Dominion Energy, and by a grant from Virginia Humanities.
During the Jim Crow era, indigenous children in Virginia weren't allowed to attend public schools. In 1952, three boys from the state's rural Middle Peninsula were put on a train west.
It was extremely difficult for our mother, and not only our mother, for the mothers of other children.
That's Matt Custolo from the Mattapani tribe. Two of the boys on that train were his older brothers.
I mean, you can imagine taking a 13 or 14-year-old child who's never been anywhere. Some of them probably, I don't know, had been as far as Richmond very, very few times in their lives. And to take that child to Richmond and put them on a train and ship them off to Oklahoma with no adult supervision. I mean, they've got to change trains and they got to get there.
There was Muskogee, Oklahoma, home of Bay Cone College and an American Indian school. Mac's two brothers carried a shoebox full of fried chicken and biscuits to eat on the way.
Mom cried her heart out, having to send your children away to a place my mom and dad had never been, didn't really know what you were sending your children into, and particularly at that age, totally unescorted. Just put them on a train and ship them away.
The third child on the train was a member of the nearby Upper Mattapani tribe, Wesley Adams. He told his story during this 2010 recording.
I went out there the first year with two people. We got on the train together, two people from the Mattapani Reservation. We got off the train in Muskogee, Oklahoma, about 2 a.m, deserted train station. And the furthest I'd ever been was to Richmond a few times. And if I had been by myself, I don't know what I'd have done.
Lou Ratchford remembers the day her brother left.
Wesley, my older brother, he got on the train. He never came back home to live.
You might ask why parents would put their children on trains to live far away from family and community, knowing some of them would never return to live. But Indigenous parents knew the importance of education being withheld by the state, so they made hard choices to give their children opportunities. This chapter is just one in a long history of a colonial playbook meant to erase our people. For hundreds of years, education in Virginia has been used as a weapon against us, sometimes to assimilate us or to change our history, always to hold us back and take our lands. At the same time, indigenous people in Virginia held tight to our cultures and ensured an education for our children. I'm Tom Tuppence, a citizen of the Upper Mattapani tribe, and this is Tribal Truths. The plot to use education against us starts in 1606. That's when the Virginia Company of London sent three ships of colonists on a 4 months journey across the Atlantic. When they arrived on our shores, they began to establish a settlement called Jamestown.
There are early colonial instructions in the months leading up to the founding of Jamestown from the crown to settlers. They need to find just means for bringing Indians to Christianity and converting them to a new religion.
That's Dylan Redigger, a scholar of Virginia history.
This involved making plans to educate people in the English language and in Christian doctrine. So they're starting to talk about that even before John Smith hits the ground running.
Captain John Smith was an English explorer, soldier, and colonizer. He worked for the Virginia Company and dealt directly with tribes that were part of the Powhatan Alliance. By 1609, he was stealing their food and destroying their towns.
The Powhatan peoples were not particularly interested in the kind of education that the English were offering. In order to find students, the English experiment with different ways of what they call acquiring children. They're interested in young people because they think young people are more malleable and more quick to learn new things.
So colonists invited indigenous children into their households to live and to be educated.
This is the way that the English children would have been educated as well. Virginia is not a place where there are schools. Education happens inside the family and inside the household.
But most indigenous families were unwilling to have their children uprooted from their communities.
To be educated in English language and Christianity involves moving into the home of an individual settler, working in a role that resembles servitude, and being kind of instructed in the cultural norms and the language as you go.
3.5 centuries after colonists arrived, children from Virginia tribes were still being separated from their families and culture to be able to get an education. As with their ancestors, they were taken into white families' homes to work and go to school. Only these schools were far from home in states like Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. During the early 1900s, a small number of schools in Virginia were built and run by Indians. But the state prevented children from completing their education past the 7th and 8th grades. Instead, the state offered a one-way ticket and stipends to parents to send their children away to private schools. Most of these were out of state. That was a tough decision for parents. Some refused. Here's Rappahannock Chief Ann Richardson.
Our people just wouldn't let their kids leave home because they knew the stories. And they had had those experiences from other tribes, and so they weren't letting their kids leave home. They knew they'd never see them again.
Our tribe had to share an Indian school, which we'll talk about later. The largest school was in Chickahominy Tribe's Samaria Indian School. In 1950, the Chickahominy and the Chickahominy Eastern Division tribes were able to establish a high school with county money. Indigenous teachers were graduates of Bacone College. The school took in some members of other tribes. Later, the two reservation tribes, the Mattapani and the Pamunkey, obtained state funding for high school courses. But during the early 1950s, parents continued to send their children out of state.
So 8 members of the Upper Mattapani tribe, 8 citizens, in the 1950s, actually traveled to Michigan to live with families they didn't even know in order to finish school.
Ken Adams is chief emeritus of the Upper Mattapani tribe. His older sister is Assistant Chief Lou Ratchford. They grew up with 8 other siblings. When they were kids, our church had a pastor from Michigan who knew people in the Flint area, so he made arrangements for some of our tribe's children to live with families in Michigan. The children paid for their room and board by doing work. Lou and Ken's older sister, Nora, worked as a housekeeper.
My sister, Nora, my oldest living sister now, living in Sacramento, she's 90 years old, she left home. She lived with the Chickahominy people for 1 year so she could go to a school with the Chickahominy people. Then she went to Bacone College for 1 year. Then she went to Michigan to live with a family she didn't even know to finish high school.
Brokenhearted parents often suffered in silence. Here's Assistant Chief Ratchford.
My mother was one of those individuals. She was very private. And so we would see her tear up and she would go into the bedroom and you know, whatever, she'd come back and you would never know that anything was bothering her. But we found out later how badly it was for her. Because like, for instance, Nora left here when she was 13 years old to go to Samaria. And she never ever came back home to live.
In those days, the only way to communicate was by letter and telephone.
I can't fathom having to go through all of that. We didn't have telephones back in those days. I mean, other people did, but we didn't have any. And so the only form of communication was a letter. So, and that's all you got, was a letter.
The children suffered too.
My sister in later years shared with us that she thought she had done something wrong that caused her to be sent away from home. She had no clue why she was being sent away from home.
She went on to become a registered nurse at Mercy Hospital in Detroit, Michigan. She never came back to live. We see her all the time, but she never came back to live.
During the Jim Crow era, Virginia attempted to wipe out Indian cultures in part by keeping indigenous children out of public white schools. Virginia was building on the federal government effort of isolating them in boarding schools across the country. This has its roots back to 1613, when the Virginia Company of London began raising funds in England to build a college here to educate indigenous students. But that idea fell apart as settlers continued to take lands and encroach on the Powhatan people's way of life. In 1622, tribes retaliated and attacked the Jamestown colony, setting off a fierce period of conflict that lasted for the next 24 years. Still, Dylan Redigger says the idea never really died.
There are traces in the record that suggest that the English were still acquiring children and educating them as part of what increasingly looked like indentured servitude throughout the 1640s and into the 1650s, but there's no longer a real determined central effort to make educating Indians through a school.
By the 1700s, indigenous captives of war with colonists were being enslaved and shipped to sugar plantations in the Caribbean. Unfortunately, some warring tribes traded their captives into enslavement as well.
And so, if you're an indigenous community, and in particular if you're a relatively small indigenous community, it's a time when there's danger from lots of different directions.
So these tribes signed a treaty in 1713 in exchange for land and protection, but Governor Alexander Spotswood saw a military opportunity. He built a fort, Christ Anna, also called Christiana, at the latest frontier of Western expansion. At the same time, he struck a deal to establish Virginia Indian Company to control all Indian trade in Virginia. He also built an Indian school.
At the school at Christiana, the students live with their families, who also live in or around the fort. They are attending essentially kind of a day school where they come and they go from school as they please.
But in his letters, Spotswood refers to Indian students as hostages who would be educated and converted to Christianity as part of a military strategy. Around the same time, another Indian school was being established in nearby Williamsburg. It was called the Brafferton Indian School.
The Brafferton School is a place where individual indigenous youths come to live on campus. And so they are separated from their communities and from their families in what look more like boarding school kind of environments.
At Brafferton, indigenous students got a full liberal arts education with math, literature, reading and writing, mechanical arts, and of course, religious studies. But the school has a dark beginning.
There was a massive domestic slave trade in the eastern portion of the country, especially the southeastern portion, where you had indigenous people who were being enslaved. You had indigenous people who were enslaving to sell on the market because they were capturing their own enemies. And like, well, this is something that we can profit from by selling them.
Ashley Spivey is an anthropologist and a member of the Pamunkey tribe. She earned her doctorate at William & Mary. More than 300 years ago, members of her tribe, including her sixth great-grandfather, John Sampson, attended William & Mary II at Brafferton Indian School. She says the school's first students were purchased from tribes who dealt in slave trading.
We don't know what communities these boys were from, but they were enslaved and sold to the College of William & Mary.
But Brafferton needed more students, so Governor Spotswood turned to the tributary tribes, the Mattapani and Pamunkey. These were tribes that had negotiated and signed treaties with the colonists. Spotswood went to their chiefs and great men to convince them to send their sons to Brafferton.
The Queen of Pamunkey at the time was like, I'm not sending my sons to you or the sons of my great men to you. And she was like, because you're going to enslave them. Our people were smart, tactful individuals. They knew what was happening. And they, because they were witnessing it, and it was happening to the children in their communities.
So the governor had to negotiate.
Okay, well, if you send your kids, we're not going to enslave them. We promise you that. And we will remit tribute while you have students at the Brafferton. And that is kind of the push to get some of the kids from the tributary tribes to start attending the Brafferton.
And as an added measure of security, the tribes negotiated for tribal escorts.
And so you had, for example, from Pamunkey, I think it was two or three boys that were sent initially in 1712 with an escort that would live with them and stay with them in Williamsburg at the Indian school.
Other tribes in the region that sent their children included the Chickahominy, Nansemond, Nottoway, Meherrin, Saponi, and Tuscarora.
Rafferton set the stage and the tone for how, again, the United States was going to handle its Indian policy, which included boarding schools.
Rafferton closed in 1790 after the Revolutionary War. While the federal government was establishing boarding schools across the country to isolate and assimilate children of other tribal nations, Virginia was working hard to erase its indigenous citizens. Instead of boarding schools, the state sought to force its tribal citizens to drop their culture and be labeled black. This would prevent them from an education equal to whites. So the tribes built and operated their own schools.
When I said that the old school was just out back, I meant it, because see those steps there? They were the steps going into the old school. They just left them there.
That's my chief, Frank Adams, of the Upper Mattapony Tribe. He's walking directly behind Cheyenne Indian School to the site of our original schoolhouse built in 1919 in King William County. The county tore it down in the early 1960s.
I mean, the footprint of the school is right here. Actually, I guess maybe it went back to this concrete. I'm not sure. It was one of those old school buildings where it had those little posts that held it up off of the ground. And this was one of them right there. The other one is right over there. And it went straight there.
Both the Cheyenne Indian School and the original site are on the National Register of Historic Places. Today, the sound of children has been replaced by tractor trailer trucks rumbling and screaming by.
It is a lot of truck traffic. This road ends up in West Point, and there's a paper mill down there, so all the trucks with logs on them are going to the paper mill. But most of the trucks now are going to a kitty litter plant that is only a mile down the road, right behind our property where we have our powwow. It's a Purina kitty litter plant, a mega plant.
The two concrete steps that lead up to the partial brick foundation are all that's left of the original schoolhouse. A modern heat pump sits on top of the brickwork, bringing air conditioning into the newer schoolhouse, built in 1952. It's now a meeting room with a showcase of tribal artifacts. Chief Emeritus Ken Adams remembers attending school in the new building when the old schoolhouse was used as a cafeteria.
So I started attending school in 1953. It was a brand new school. You had to go outside to get into that building. I remember standing on the steps in the winter when it was mighty cold, and we were all waiting to get inside the lunchroom. All of the kids had lunch in there, and some of the tribal ladies actually prepared the lunch for the kids.
In 1870, Virginia mandated public schools, but they were segregated. We built our schools to reinforce our cultures and sovereignty in Virginia. But the state officials made sure we couldn't graduate from our schools and we couldn't attend white public schools. During the 1940s and 50s, our school only went as far as the eighth grade.
Nobody ever graduated from Cheyenne Indian School. No one ever graduated from Cheyenne Indian School. And years later, I would think to myself, I wonder why.
We did not go to public schools. Because of the Racial Integrity Act in 24, it was like two races in Virginia were recognized, and they were white and colored.
The Racial Integrity Act of 1924 was devised as part of the eugenics movement by white men to keep their race pure. It made it illegal to identify as an Indian. Before that were Jim Crow laws. From 1919, when the school was built, all of Ken Adams and Lou Ratchford's family attended the old or new Cheyenne Indian School, including their mother.
And our families wanted to retain our Native American identity, and so they refused to send our children to public schools because we would, of course, had to go to the colored schools.
Those schools, like the Indian schools, were purposely underfunded by the state, and in our case, by the county. For Indian children to get an education, the parents had to build them a school and provide a teacher. Some received help from local churches. We used our own money and skills to build the original Sharon Indian School.
And at that time, it was a small building. It was like a slab, you know, like wood, one room. In addition to the school being used as a school, the tribal citizens also attended church there before the church building was built in the 1940s.
Stories about the old school were passed on to younger kids.
You know, it was heated with an old wood stove. There are people that I know of today that would say there were cracks in the floor. There were cracks in the floor of the school. And I remember one person talking about, if you dropped a nickel in the floor, you better grab it quick because it's going to go through the cracks.
Mrs. Helen Hill, who taught there, said her wedding ring fell through one of the floorboards to the ground below, and one of the children crawled under the school to get it. As with Mrs. Hill's wedding ring, stories of how segregation laws affected indigenous communities in Virginia fell into a crack. We endured the same racism as African Americans. Ken remembers what happened to his older siblings when the old school became overcrowded.
Four of them. They went to school in the woodshed. There was no room. They went to school in the early 1950s before the new school was built in a woodshed.
Our tribe also couldn't afford salaries to attract highly qualified teachers.
And my brother Wesley said to me when he got later on in years, he said, the teacher that taught me in that woodshed didn't know a lick about what he was doing. He said, I had to go and repeat the ninth grade because I didn't learn a whole lot with this guy.
But some made great efforts to teach us, like Ken and Lou's cousin Rudy, who went on to become a pharmacist. Rudy taught for a brief time when the school needed a teacher. Matt Cussolo recalls a story from his father about a teacher at the Mattapani Reservation School during the early 1900s. He told this story while out fishing near his home.
My dad said that there was a school teacher who lived down the river, probably a mile and a half. And in the winter, he built a sled with a sail on it. And he would actually go down in the morning to the river, push it over, run the sail up, and sail up here to the reservation to teach school. And at the end of the day, go down to the river, push the sled out, run the sail up, and sail back home. Mr. Edwards was his name.
Because the state refused to help us, indigenous schools also couldn't afford books and other teaching materials used in white public schools or to buy school buses. Then in 1925, the King William County School Board offered to take over administration of our school. Our people thought this arrangement might put our school on equal footing with white schools, but there was a catch. We had to transfer the title for our land to the county for the life of the school, a modern land grab. In return, the county gave us used books from the white schools. Both Chief Frank Adams and Chief Emeritus Ken Adams remember the condition of those books, even when they attended during the 1950s.
Yeah, they were all had names written in them, and dog-eared pages and all kinds of stuff.
I don't ever recall getting any new books. The old books that we received, some of them, you know, you can see where they had put their name in the book, and sometimes it was 3 or 4 years worth of names in that one book, and then we would get the hand-me-down books from the white school. But we still did well.
The county paid our teachers well below what they paid teachers in white schools, even into the 1960s. And getting to school could be a challenge too. At first, they gave us an old panel van kids called the bus.
For years, we didn't have a school bus. Most of the kids would either walk, when I was coming, ride a bike to school or something like that, but it wasn't any school bus. Then we got a bus that my mother started driving, picking up kids.
For more than a century, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were taken from their communities and forced into boarding schools run by the U.S. government, specifically the Department of the Interior, and religious institutions. The languages, cultures, religions, traditional practices, and even the history of Native communities, all of it was targeted for destruction.
That's former Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland. Beginning in 2022, she oversaw the release of two reports on investigations into federal Indian boarding schools. It has taken more than a century for U.S. and Canadian governments and churches to begin to lay a path to heal the wounds inflicted by their schools. Here in Virginia, that painful legacy began in the late 1800s. There's a famous quote, "Kill the Indian, save the man," attributed to Richard Henry Pratt, a former Brigadier General in the U.S. Army. In the spring of 1878, he took 70 indigenous men and women to what we now know as Hampton University in Eastern Virginia. They were prisoners of war. Brought from tribes outside of Virginia, they were the first class of Native American students at Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute, a school for African American youth.
And there, they were basically educated, right? I just said educated in quotes. They were taught to read and write. And General Pratt was like, hey, I think we've got a model here. The model had already been built, and it was the Braverton. So literally, hostages.
The new school was one of many Indian boarding schools that were established around this time in the U.S. and Canada. 1 year after the Hampton Indian School was founded, the Carlisle Industrial Indian School was established in Pennsylvania. Indigenous children there were abused, overworked, and underfed. The Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs founded 24 more American Indian boarding schools after Carlisle.
It's all connected, and it's all based in this idea of violence, right? These were hostages, these were prisoners of war. And then, of course, the violence of ripping you away from your communities and your culture and your language and placing you in a setting to learn how to be different so that you can then take that back to your people and teach them how to be different and not to be indigenous.
During the 40 years the Hampton Indian School existed, some Virginia Indians tried to enroll.
Pamunkey, for example, petitioned General Pratt to have students go to the Indian School. At that time, education was seen as a way for our people to economically survive. They wanted to pursue education to benefit their people, and so they only had one avenue open to them at that time. So they petitioned to try and send students, young folks from Pamunkey, to Hampton.
But the federal government wouldn't allow Pamunkey students into the Indian school. Space in the school was reserved to assimilate tribes the U.S. government had been at war with. Still, the Pamunkey tribe persisted.
There were three Bradby brothers from Pamunkey, and again, pursuit of education was considered something important to Pamunkey parents and to Pamunkey leadership. So one went to the normal school at Hampton, and then for whatever reason, I don't know why they were separated, the other two brothers were sent to Carlisle. So they did attend Carlisle, and one was able to graduate and ended up staying in Pennsylvania. And the other one, for whatever reasons I can't even begin to imagine, was not able to stay there. He kept running away.
Some never left Carlisle. The remains of more than 180 Native American and Alaska Native children are buried there. Hampton University has a cemetery where 38 Indigenous students are buried. None are from Virginia tribes. Fast forward to 1954. And a landmark case, Brown versus the Board of Education, that banned segregation. But it wasn't until the Civil Rights Act in 1964 desegregation was enforced and the schools were integrated. In Virginia, racism had woven itself tightly into most European American cultures. Sue Branham is a citizen of the Monacan tribe in Amherst County, Virginia. In the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, the tribe built a private school with the help from the Episcopal Church.
We are here in the Monacan Indian Schoolhouse. It is a historical landmark. It was built in the 1860s and remained a school until 1965 was the last school year here. One of the things that I recall my brother and sister being lined up outside of this building by the county, and they would say, okay, you look white enough, you look too Indian. You look white enough, you look too Indian. So they took a handful of the students out of here and allowed them to go into the white schools in 63. So then the school continued to run, like I said, until 65 with the darker ones. And for the first, in my mind, the first time in our tribe, we started looking at each other differently. Then it was like, well, why does so-and-so get to go and I have to stay here? Why can't I ride the school bus? Why can't I go to that big school? You know, it's because you're darker. So it created a rift within our own people for the first time over color of your skin.
Rappahannock Chief Ann Richardson said her tribe had schools in Caroline and Essex County and at Indian Neck. All were run by tribal members. None were supported by the state.
Our school closed before the Civil Rights Act. We were considered an unaccredited school. And I guess accreditation must have come about around that time. And so they closed our school, and my dad had to go to the governor because there was no school for us to go to. And he did an executive order that allowed us to go over to Upper Mattapony School. And our county bused our children over there.
Getting an education could be piecemeal. Chief Ann remembers attending multiple schools outside of her community until schools were fully integrated in 1965. Even that was hard.
Chief Frank and I went to school together, and then we were able to go into the public school, and so we went to Marriott Public Schools, which was not an easy thing to do because it was prior to integration. So that was a difficult thing. And then they integrated schools. And then we went to what was the Black High School, almost an hour away on a bus. And so school was difficult for us and our generation.
Chief Frank Adams started sixth grade at the white school.
I remember the first year or second year, we drew names for Christmas, so everybody had to get somebody a Christmas present. So I got a bar of soap for my Christmas present from the student in school. I guess they wanted me to take a bath. I wasn't clean enough for them. The first black student that came out of the Hampton Homeschool, Dorothy, she was in my class also, and she got a worse gift than that. It was a pony manure. One of the kids had a pony, so he boxed up some, gave it to her for a Christmas present. And I ran track, and I would be running around the track doing a track meet, and all the kids, so-called classmates, would be sitting up there going, you know, run, Indian, run, and things like that, you know, which didn't feel good, but it just happened. But, you know, growing up Indian, you have to have a very thick skin, so.
And remember how King William County took over Upper Mattapony land and our school in 1922? That was so we could get teachers and books. Our tribe's agreement with the county was our property would be returned to us if the school ever closed. But after integration, when Sharon Indian School was closed in 1965, the county maintained their ownership and refused to acknowledge our agreement. At one point, our school was being used by Virginia Tech as agricultural extension office. So began yet another fight to get our land back.
The whole time the school belonged to the county, when really the sacrifice was made by the Upper Mattapony people who struggled to feed their families, but also realized that education was so important to the success of the tribe that they decided to build their own school.
For 20 years, our leaders asked the county to return our school. On December 1985, we asked again. Here's Professor Helen Rountree speaking before the King William County Board of Supervisors on our behalf.
I'm a cultural anthropologist specializing in American Indian history from Old Dominion University. The school building we're discussing is the third non-reservation Indian school in the state and the only one which has a prayer of being returned to any of the involved tribes. The eldest was an Ansamon, and that's been demolished. The second was a Chickahominy, and it's still in service as a county school, and the tribe has very little chance of getting it back. You have a chance of returning a building that is not only historically significant, but also extremely emotionally significant to the people because it was a public recognition of their Indianness in a time when they were under a great deal of fire from Richmond. I think that in the name of justice, you should also consider that, please. Thank you.
Mattapani Chief Webster Cuslow also spoke.
I'm the father of Dr. Linwood Cuslow, who was chief of the Upper Mattapani Tribe, when we're speaking of tonight. And tonight, I speak in behalf of the Upper Mattapani Tribe and our interest in the relinquishing of the old Sharon Indian School back to their personal possession. I feel this relinquishment can be honorably and peacefully executed by the government of King William County.
Finally, on that December evening, the board voted unanimously to return Sharon Indian School and 2 acres of land.
To move that this board give the facility back to the Upper Mattapani Indian Tribe, lock, stock, and barrel.
Today, it's late July, it's steamy after raining off and on, but under a pavilion at the Upper Mattapani Tribal Center, our kids are in the middle of a week-long tribal youth camp. Gourds they painted are hanging to dry along the pavilion roofline, like brightly decorated bells. Standing above the tiny, eager crowd is my 23-year-old cousin, Connor Tuppence.
They're doing stuff like archery, they're learning traditional games, they're doing pottery, a lot of traditional skills, but also a lot of team building activities, a lot of community building activities. The biggest goal here is for the kids to get to know each other.
He's trying to herd the kids into a circle to watch a girl from the tribe demonstrate a dance they learned for a mini powwow on their last day. Next door at the Tribal Center, Chief Frank Adams knows there's hard work ahead.
We understand the struggle of getting teenagers and youngsters to do things, you know, so we work extra hard to try to get them involved because invariably, if they're not involved when they're a teenager, when they get 30 years old, they'll say, oh, I wish I'd been more involved, and then can I still learn? I said, sure you can, but you're going to sit in a class with teenagers.
Since federal recognition, the tribe has been purchasing former lands and slowly bringing back those members of our communities who moved away to survive. Our cultures traditionally look ahead to the next 7 generations. Connor and other tribal youth are helping us to build that future.
In a time right now where the tribe is so spread out, we have a small community, a small number of people living within the community, but we have kids that just live everywhere. And one thing that we've missed out on for generations is keeping that community together and letting kids, you know, come up together. So it's take opportunity to take these folks and, you know, build a cultural identity in them, let them all get to know each other. So these are going to be our next generation of tribal leaders and community leaders.
You guys got it? All right, let's try it.
Tribal music is written by Rose Hill Singers and performed by Red Blanket Singers of the Nanticoke Lanai Lenape Tribe of New Jersey and features the Jingle Dress Song. Tribal Truths is reported, written, and sound designed by Pamela D'Angelo. Kelly Libby is editor. Additional editing by David Seidel and Tom Tuppence. Support is provided by Virginia Humanities. And Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Commonwealth History Fund, presented by Dominion Energy. Additional support is by WVTF Radio IQ. Other music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions. If you want to learn more, visit radioiq.org for links and resources.